That's Steve Turi, one of my very favorite trombonists, opening up on the title track of his 14th album, Rainbow People, released in 2008. Sean Jones on trumpet and flugelhorn, Peter Washington on bass, Ignacio Berroa on drums, Pedro Martinez on percussion, Kenny Garrett on alto sax, and Mulgrew Miller on piano and keyboards. Steve Turi is also a musical seashell virtuoso. Yes, he plays seashells. He's also a composer, arranger, and educator at the collegiate conservatory level and has been performing as a jazz artist and rock and Latin jazz genres as well for more than 50 years. And apart from that, he is just incredibly, incredibly handsome. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. And today, we switch gears. We've taken a look at the Democrats, and then we look on the other side of the fence today. The presidential race, as you know, is in full throttle. Skirmishes earlier this month in Iowa and New Hampshire have winnowed the ranks of contenders, and a further culling might occur before Super Tuesday on March the 1st, after primaries in Nevada and South Carolina. We've been discussing the shenanigans of the Democratic side, and the fierce battle, of course, was featured there between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who each want to be the standard bearer in the general election. So let's take a look at how the other wing of the duopoly is faring as six survivors of a brutal political editing execute an offensive counteroffensive. So that's where we're going today. Let's talk about the tone and the tenor of the campaign and what you get from it. And we'll be opening up the phone lines very shortly, but I think it is important to get a sense of how the Republican side is approaching this election. I did lay out some time ago what I felt to be a very important way to look at this year's presidential race. And it has to do with race. The permanent flaw, the permanent flawed thread in the fabric of American life. And both sides are playing the same game. Essentially, we are having and we are witnessing a conversation that white America is having with itself. Now, the Democrats define that conversation one way. The Republicans seem to be defining it another way. And in any event, there is unanimity of agreement, it seems, that there must be a reorganization of life and all things American, because the anticipated demographic change, which could only be described as cataclysmic, seismic in proportion, looms right around the corner, 2032, according to the U.S. Bureau of the Census, when the official minority in the United States will be European. Non-whites will, in fact, be the majority population by then, says the Bureau of the Census, and they should know what they're talking about. This is their job. They do demographic studies. And they're predicting this shift. It will occur by 2032, but could occur even sooner. In fact, as I speak, more than 11 counties throughout the United States have already made that shift. So it has begun. Now, the Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, those are the two left standing, are dealing with this in a particular way, but each having a twist, a little twist, on how they present themselves. But there is agreement just the same, because they have to tailor their message in order to get the vote, this thing called the vote. And because the Democratic Party, especially in recent decades, has become the party of non-whites in the United States in terms of, you know, the gravitational pull, they are, as I call them, the kindling. These are the people who bring fuel to the fire that warms everybody else. They don't benefit from the heat they generate. They just are there to bring the heat, i.e., their votes, so as to make it official that a democratic process has occurred. And in that little charade, that game that is played, you have to have the necessary pandering to, quote, constituencies, unquote, and you have to talk about things that would attract somebody's attention and make them believe that you actually have them on your radar screen as a candidate. But if you pay attention to what the Democrats are presenting to this vast sea of would-be voters, people who, again, will be expected to turn up at the polls and vote for them, you see that the conversation with respect to what you could describe loosely as interests panders to the pathological. We're not talking about jobs. We're not talking about quality of life. We're not talking about the issues that people have identified historically as being important to them. The conversation is still rooted in how the candidates, Clinton and Sanders, choose to respond to these constituencies, and the areas of attention have to do with the pathological profiles of these communities. Crime, prison, single female-headed households, you know, the historical stuff. As if that is what matters to African Americans all the time, and that these are the issues that are number one. Nobody bothers to ask people, well, what's on your mind? And they may be surprised to know, for example, that adult unemployment is huge. People object to an unemployment rate that is akin to that experienced during the Great Depression of the 1920s. Or that teenage unemployment is just unimaginable. In some cases, it is estimated that 60 or and higher percentage of young people wanting a job can't find it in African American and Latino communities. They may find that the issue is the summary and wholesale closing down of the public school system, the systematic emptying of the communities because these communities are targeted for reinvention. They may find that foreclosures were a big issue and have been since the 1970s. But because they have a one-dimensional view of these communities as largely bacteria contained in a petri dish, they can't imagine that these communities have anything in common with white America, white middle-class America. They can't imagine that African Americans and Latinos are concerned about accumulation of wealth and the transference of wealth and the systematic denial of opportunities to acquire wealth through unemployment, you know, consistent unemployment, They can't imagine these issues being relevant in these communities. So they talk about these things, prison, they urge reforms. Let's have a prison system that is more efficient, shall we? Let's have police officers who know how to apply a chokehold. Okay? Let's do that kind of reform. But let's not view these communities as having anything in common with the communities that historically have been part of the ruling class, even if they're not part of the ruling elite. Okay. The Republicans are sending us an interesting message on the basis of race as well. Well, Donald Trump made it very clear what his attitude is in the way he singled out Mexicans and Muslims and, non-whites as pretty much the causes of ill-ease and dis-ease in this country. The people who are causing upheavals, unnecessary upheavals, social, political, and economic. And then we have those candidates who have, for the purposes of making themselves appealing to Republicans, they have deracinated themselves. They have denatured themselves so as to be seen, if not by skin color as white, certainly by temperament and by ideological leaning as being extremely loyal to the standing order. So you would have a Marco Rubio who will describe himself not as a white person. He would not say he's white, but he's saying he's white. And in the political sense, I'll get to this in a minute, Rubio has already declared himself pretty much, he's constantly described as born of a Cuban father and an American mother. What does that mean? Well, he's telling you without telling you. He's born out of that cultural and historical period in Cuba, the colonial period, where the sons and daughters of the privileged and the plantocracy of Cuba ruled, consistent with the nature of white supremacy. And that's what Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz have in common. They have deracinated themselves. Ben Carson, we can see, of course, Ben Carson, physiologically he presents as an African-American man, but there's, in one sentence or two, we can gather that a process has occurred there of deracination, because he preaches and he's adopted the credo, which is based in white supremacist thinking. So he looks at the African-American community through the same prism in order to assure the party, because this is what infuses the philosophy, to assure them that he's safe. He's safe and he qualifies to be a Republican in the ideological sense. He does not defy or challenge in any way the standing order. Pretty much a repeat of Barack Obama, but perhaps a more pathetic expression of that. Now, this is where both Democrats and Republicans agree. And this is where the conversation is the same on both sides. This is the conversation that is being had across ideological lines. They differ only in the question of who will rule personally, who will be the individual to ascend to the throne of total power, autocratic rule, masking it with a little, you know, American democracy, blah, 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 blah. But they do not differ at all with the original concept of who should rule and who should be ruled. They don't differ at all. Which is why I continue to be amazed that the African American and to a large degree the Latino community's leadership actually have become full-fledged proselytizers for both the Democratic and Republican parties, severing what should be the root of a decision, the root of a consciousness, severing all of that from what they present as an election, when that is in fact the reason for political activism, it seems to be. What is it? What's in it for me? What's in it for my people? What's in it for those people similarly situated? This process called elections. Why should I care that one person is a Democrat and the other one is a Republican? Why should that matter to me? They're sending the same message. They all agree. They have me already categorized as to where I belong and what treatment ought to be accorded me and who has the power to deliver, if they so choose to deliver, what it is I seek for my survival. That's not on their table. And you have to understand how logical that is. It's logical, after all, that people who are in power and who are conscious of their moment in time where we are in the United States, we are at a time of a dramatic shift. This demographic shift is undeniable. It's coming. And it means that there is a consciousness now to reassemble and reconfigure their ways of doing things in order to maintain absolute control. If we have arrived at the point where we think, well, you know, look how far we have come. You know, you hear this nonsense. You hear this silly nonsense all the time. We have come so far. No, we haven't come so far at all. We are still in that equation, a lopsided equation. The power equation has not changed at all. But with this demographic shift, we find that the system is doing what it historically did. When the numbers are off, because power, in a sense, requires at least to maintain some sense of the American ideal, the myth of the democratic America, that everybody is, you know, we're all one family, as Barack Obama keeps telling us, we're one family. To maintain that myth, to keep that going, you will need to have a dominant group. The dominant group is dwindling numerically. So what they do is you put a little bit of elastic in here and you let people in just to fill up the ranks a little bit because it's necessary. On the Democratic side, I'm showing you how consistent it is across ideological lines, is both parties are doing the same thing. On the Democratic side, we have a white female. Well, Hillary Clinton does claim to have Native American ancestry someplace in there. But we know she's running as a white woman. And who has already benefited from the opportunities and advantages of being a white female in the United States? Bernie Sanders would be, if he wins, the first Jewish American to have broken through. And you notice, he doesn't talk very often about being Jewish. Because it is to be conveyed ever so subtly by both Hillary Clinton and who, by the way, Hillary Clinton, Germanic and Welsh roots, I suppose. That's what she claims. But, you know, she lies so often. Who knows what the deal is there? But you have two people on the Democratic side who have gained, as they understand it, membership in the white world of ruling. They've been admitted. On the Republican side, Donald Trump. You know, let me finish with the Democratic side first. You know, it wasn't too long ago that it would have been impossible for Bernie Sanders to reach that level. That's just a blink of an eye ago. Jews were not permitted in Wall Street. Jews were not permitted even in colleges. City College in New York, created specifically to accommodate Jews who were excised. They were not at all permitted. They were not permitted in many professions in this country. And it wasn't too long ago that they were, in fact, forced to create their own systems, parallel systems, simply to survive and to bide their time to integrate. Many changed their names. Hello, Donald Trump. Drumpf. That's his family name, Drumpf. So his folks made the transition on the Republican side. Ted Cruz speaks entirely differently about even his religion. He says, well, the customary religion would be Catholicism when you come from Cuba. He says he's an evangelical. These are evangelical candidates. And you have my permission to read that in its racial context. It means white religious people. Black religious people are not called evangelicals. They don't get polled among the evangelicals of the country. Black people, Latinos, who are very, very faith-based, they're different. They're Protestants and, you know, various other religions. They don't get called evangelicals. So the word actually is meant as a signal to say, we're talking about white people who have some kind of a religious identity. That's the code word, the evangelicals. See, only white people in America could be evangelical. But we have two evangelicals, although their Latino background, again, very surgically erased. And then we have Jeb Bush, who actually is kind of like, well, if he didn't marry a Latina, he would be almost the only real white man in the race. Not only did he marry a Latina, but he had children, and he speaks Spanish. My God, what a dilemma. No wonder he's last. Because there is a racial pecking order occurring. People are not observing it, but I've been studying it among the Republicans. The party is meant to stand for racial purity and the American values. All these are code words. You understand what they're talking about. What they're saying is, look, this is our business. This doesn't concern you. Go to the Democrats. They take anybody. They're like Martin Luther King and all those, you know, those freedom riders and people like that. That's their camp. We are the racial purity camp. And everybody, regardless of their cultural background, is holding to the white American, the historically white American standard of power. And it makes no difference. The ideological differences are really unimportant here, because there really isn't an ideological difference. Both sides subscribe to white supremacist thinking. Now, I'm sure people are going to say, well, now this woman has lost her mind. How could you come to a conclusion like that? You observe. You observe. When we look at this race in the context of this seismic shift that I talk about, the demographic shift, what we understand is that the system has a job to do beginning now. In fact, some would even say it's a late start, because they don't have much time to get it together before 2032. By then, the order ought to be absolutely complete. The reordering as to who has power, who has control, who dominates and who is dominated. And in the 50s and 60s and 70s and all of that stuff, what was going on was, there was a little miscegenation going on there. But then, I'm sure people said, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? We are being outnumbered. We're being outnumbered. And it is important for us to be numerically significant enough, at least if only for psychological reasons, to maintain a semblance of control, visible control. But more whites are dying than are being born. Families are smaller than they used to be. The whole notion of whiteness has changed through intermarriage, miscegenation. Intermarriage and miscegenation has weakened the purity of whiteness in the United States. And if you are built on the thinking of white supremacy, you can't now settle for impurities in your genetic pool. And you can't feel comfortable with the idea of being outnumbered. So consistent with this fear, you see the issues of gun control being very, very important. You see the issue of immigration being very, very important. You see this question of same-sex marriage and all these things that are adopted as, quote, conservative values. You see the rise of the evangelicals. That's white people who consider themselves to be more religious than everybody else. You see cities being under attack, especially those cities that have very large non-white populations. It used to be that that's exactly what they wanted. They drove through all kinds of means. They attracted these large populations to these urban areas and surrounded them. That's the advent of the suburbs. But now they can't afford to live in the suburbs. They're coming back right straight to urban America. A displacement has to occur. So you see the targeted cities, Detroit, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York City. You see the advent of bankruptcies, forced bankruptcies. You see even the poisoning of water in Flint. You see incredible environmental disasters occurring where people of color live, so as to empty the urban centers and reverse the process. You see an emphasis on immigration placed on European immigration and an absolute targeting of everybody else, especially people of color, Mexicans. It's not accidental that Mexicans ended up being at the number one on Trump's list. The most educated immigrant into the United States happens to be African. The Census Bureau says that. They arrive in the United States with more education than any other immigrant from any other part of the world. But immigration from Africa strictly controlled. So you see things becoming, quote, issues, unquote, because they reflect an abiding fear that is linked directly to continuing white supremacist control of the United States. That's what's happening. They're presented as issues, but they're not just issues. These are small aspects, but they're related aspects of the whole program. This election is meant to be to achieve a specific task, and that is to advance the reorganization of our society, to make a decisive move to return the United States to its previous condition of servitude for many people in it. And the realignment, you see? And both the Democrats and the Republicans have the same language. You know, the Democrats talk about the income gap. What are you talking about? The income gap. They have nice coded words for it. But they're talking about the income gap because white people are now, the white middle class is suffering. The white elite got so powerful, it started ghettoizing white communities on the basis of white people, on the basis of their income. So many whites became blacks and Latinos. They converted them. If you're white and American, you can't make it. It is because you have adopted that way of thinking and operating, that you can't find a job. And that's why Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton long ago began his welfare reform, the Work for Food program, meant to punish people who slipped. Because being white in America means you're guaranteed a job. You must have become a little too lazy. You see? That thinking operates on both sides of the aisle. So there is a reordering, and make no mistake about it. This is what is happening. A reordering of the structure of white supremacy. Yeah, shuffling the chairs, the deck chairs. Because 2032 is staring us in the face, and something has got to be done to make a decisive blow. You know, this business of Barack Obama's election, this was not supposed to happen. And it happened, and then it happened for yet another terrifying reason. Barack Obama's election really scared a large portion of America. Why? Because it rested on the power of the powerless, the people who were supposed to have no power. Those were the ones who elected him. And the white sympathizers. The price that everybody paid was that Barack Obama, of course, was more loyal to the system than to the people who elected him. Twice. And even now, when he has a chance to kind of indicate, well, you know, I have nothing to lose, I'm on my way out, what does he do? He has already indicated that Hillary Clinton is the preference. A person who is lethal to the interests of all people, let alone those who historically have been suffering in this country. He deracinated. He was compelled to. He felt the need to. This is a man who, at the drop of a hat, even his own spiritual advisor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, you remember what happened to him? Obama said, I don't know this guy at all. I would not have a pastor of mine talk these kinds of things, say these kinds of things, and these are radical ideas. When he's describing what anybody even vaguely familiar with the black church and the whole concept of liberation theology, which goes back literally hundreds of years, Reverend Wright is a spectacular example of that tradition. Speaking truth, but a truth that requires a certain amount of political courage. The price Barack Obama was prepared to pay was the price that Jesse Jackson was prepared to pay, which is, I would put all of my folks on the auction block. I will bring them into your fold. I will put them under heavy manners. You could count on me to control them. And you'll see a whole bunch of them popping up in the course of the next few weeks and months when they are going to be compelled, we talked about this in the guise of the super delegates in the party, will have to deliver to Hillary Clinton. She is the heir apparent to white supremacy within the Democratic Party, which, again, we have to always keep history in mind, was the party of the slavocracy South. Still is. So make no mistake, the Republicans now, they revved up their thing and they're cussing each other out and saying bad things about each other. But the fact is, they're real clear. And they make no apologies. That's the only difference I would say. It's a matter of clarity. The Republicans are very clear and they are very deliberate about the message that they are sending. They're sending the message, every single one of the candidates, irrespective of their so-called cultural orientation and history, they are sending the message. They understand the job that they are expected to do. The job they're expected to do is to accomplish the realignment of America. In accordance with its, quote, traditional values. You know, when they say things like, red lights ought to go off in your head. What are American values? And are they worth having? American values, for many, it's a very bad thing. Nothing good came out of American values. American values included genocide. It included absolute segregation. It includes a long, protracted history of injustice. It includes a lot of ugliness in pursuit of domination, power and domination. The Republican Party is rededicating itself to that. The Democratic Party is having a little diplomatic issue. It can't say out loud that that's really what we're about, but it is in fact what they're about. They have to be a little softer about it because they have to give the illusion that they're delivering for the constituencies that will be counted on to bail them out. So, yeah, I give you a little symbolic deference. And they start talking about you just the same in very pathological terms. I am for prison reform. Okay, well, that's nice. So you want the prisons to function more efficiently. Are you for prosecuting prosecutors who don't prosecute? Are you for firing the U.S. Attorney General? Are you against forced bankruptcies? I am against what happened in Flint is immoral. No kidding. Your silence is immoral. Your silence about the Flints of America is immoral because it's been in existence for a long time. Where were you? Right there in the city you come from, in Chicago, before you became a transplanted New Yorker, right there in the city of Chicago, you have all kinds of huge problems. And the mayor is the guy who was the chief of staff to your husband, the co-president of the United States, Bill Clinton. You should have been on top of the situation in Chicago. The schools being shut down. You should be on top of the budget crisis that will be balanced on the backs of people who don't have jobs in Chicago. You should be on top of that. But it does know, you see, she goes to, this is Hillary, she goes to Harlem to talk to the victims of racism about racism. She's conducting a kind of educational seminar in a community where the problem is not. There's no real anti-black racism in Harlem. But you would not dare go to Arkansas and talk to whites about racism. She's not going to white churches in South Carolina where the problem is. That young man that killed all those people, all nine of them, comes from a white church-going community. He even prayed with the black folks before he shot and killed them. So let's not have any illusions here that this is about an election. This is a time for people of conscience to just take it slow, take it all in, and reconfigure an alternative to this nonsense and compel yourself to make it stop. You can't make it stop. You can make yourself stop participating in it. Get real. And truly become activist. Once you begin to understand what is going on here, it's right around the corner. It will occur in many, many people's lifetimes that I'm talking to right now. We have to put together systems that function independently of the system. The system has perfected the art of genocidal control. You want to, hallucinate and think that this is about, you're an American and you're participating in the democratic process and all that other bilge. You want to do that? You go right ahead. But I tell you, you'd be doing a great disservice. You are not the beneficiary of the system. You are the target of it. So, all people who understand this, I don't care what your cultural orientation is, I don't care what your genetic makeup is, if you get that message, you can't possibly believe that come November, your job is to do your part to maintain this putrid system. You should be about finding ways and talking with other people. This is why we have a community of interest here on this program. You should be about sharing your ideas, and beyond sharing ideas, acting on them to create independent systems that speak specifically to your interests and your needs. And number one on that list is the need to survive and to thrive. We'll continue talking about the duopoly and this carnival that is being staged. We know the fix is in. We know the system is rigged. That is not the problem. The problem is that we don't seem to do much with the knowledge that we have. We know that the system is rigged. We know it is not going to function in the interests of the vast majority of people. But we also lay down on the job and we look for somebody else to formulate an answer. And when they do, in accordance with their interests, we get angry and we start complaining, when in fact it just is a logical thing. Who the heck is going to put something together for your benefit if the intention is to rub you out? Make your life a living hell. So I'm going to leave it there for today. I hope it causes you to do some thinking. You'll let me know, I hope, at leadstories@gmail.com. Keep it right here. Coming up next, a wonderful program, Expanding Mind. with Eric Davis. You want to stay tuned for that. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Don't forget, tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday. Hopefully, we'll have a lot to talk about and your brains will be in gear. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.